Dr. Thomas Yadigar, ICU director, Providence Cedars-Sinai Tarzana Medical Center. Obviously, this guy is no slouch. He is worth listening to. He's a pulmonologist who says he has some important information to share with the public and doctors around the world. Welcome, doctor. How are you?
I'm well, Glenn. How are you doing?
Good. I appreciate you having the guts to come on and possibly say things that some people don't want people to hear. It's weird, this situation that we're in right now. How can you help us navigate?
Well, you know, we've been treating patients for probably about 6 to 7 weeks. And the first few weeks, it was our experience was the same as everywhere else, where patients were coming in. They were becoming very ill on the floor. We really couldn't figure out why. We had to put them on ventilators. And before very long, I just saw more and more patients in my intensive care unit. And the thing that was very concerning was that, one, I didn't really understand what the process was that was causing them to get so sick. And two, what was really unusual was that it almost seemed like every single patient had a different type of a disease process. Yes, they had what we thought was pneumonia. Yes, they were on a ventilator, but they weren't necessarily acting the same. If I can take you back to 10 years ago when we had the H1N1 epidemic, you know, at that time I may have had 10, 15 patients that were on ventilators. But I can go into each room, and each of them had the same kind of pathophysiology. Maybe they were at a different stage of the disease, but essentially it was the same disease, which caused us to be able to predict what was going to happen. In these types of patients, there's really no predictability to it. Everyone does something that's unique to themselves. And that's what makes it so difficult to treat because, you know, you have no idea what's going to happen the next day.
That's kind of scary. Is there another disease like this or another virus like this?
You know, I've been a pulmonary critical care doctor for 20 years, and I've been the medical director for over 10 years. And no, I have not seen this before in my experience. So I've been dealing with respiratory infections.
So that would make it. Go ahead.
I've just been dealing with respiratory infections of all types of viruses, bacteria, even fungal infections. You know, there's always some sort of predictability. You know, there's always some sort of a disease pattern. Once you recognize a pattern, you can make the diagnosis, and then you could predict what's going to happen, and you could start a treatment plan, which, you know, will hopefully help the patient. In these types of patients, there really isn't any predictability.
So doesn't that make this harder to treat, and wouldn't that say, don't go to work? Because we don't have a handle on it.
I guess. I mean, I guess it depends on where you're coming from. I was initially I trained in the 1990s in medical school in my internship. That was during the HIV pandemic, and to many, many different factors, this kind of reminds me of that. You know, there is a lot of fear, and unfortunately, that's what we've kind of fed into, as opposed to science and fact and logic. And, you know, people don't want to necessarily go into the rooms and treat these patients and see them, which I can understand. You know, that there are, I've spoken to many doctors, many nurses, and some of them, not so much for the fear of their own lives, but some of them have spouses that are on, you know, that may have had transplants or on immunosuppressive therapy. And they're just concerned that, you know, not only can I die, but I can take something back home to my loved ones and hurt them. And that's not an unusual thought. I mean, the same thought went through my head as well. I think that's normal. But you just have to say, okay, but I'm a physician. I'm a nurse. I'm a healthcare provider. I'm trained for this. I'm going to do the best possible to protect myself, and I'm going to do everything possible to protect my family. But I have to treat these patients. Someone has to treat these patients.
Okay, so you've just been asked to command, you know, regionally across 4 more hospitals because you are performing way above, you and your team, above any of the hospitals in the Los Angeles area. You haven't lost a single patient. No one has had to go on a ventilator. And you say that you have a protocol where you can find certain markers and you'll know who will crash and who won't.
Well, first of all, under normal circumstances, there's 20 physicians that I supervise, and we take care of patients at two different hospitals. Usually on a daily basis, we take care of 100 to 125 patients, about 30 to 40 of them that are in the intensive care unit. I work both at Providence Cedars-Sinai Tarzana Medical Center as well as West Hills Medical Center, although I'm not speaking for any entity. This is just my personal observation. I just want to make that clear.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
But that's our normal team that we normally take care of patients. And, you know, initially what was happening was, again, you know, patients were coming into the hospital. They were getting sicker. We're putting them in the ICU. And I just thought, okay, I don't understand what's happening. So I started reading. I started researching. And one of the things that I first came up with was that, you know, these patients are having what's called a cytokine storm syndrome. And this is a very rare.
That's what happened in – that happened in 1918 with pandemic as well, did it not?
I believe so, although I'm not sure at that time that, you know, we had the technology to really find out exactly what was happening on a molecular basis. But right. In this syndrome, what happens is that, you know, the patients that get very, very sick, the immune system normally mounts a response, right? So if you get a bacteria, if you get a virus, it activates your immune system. And then the immune system coordinates its activity so that it can destroy the virus or the bacteria. But in a subset of patients, the immune system kind of goes awry. It doesn't act normally. And the immune system gets super ramped up. And instead of attacking the virus, it starts actually attacking the patient's own vital organs. So what I started noticing was that, you know what, these patients that are going on the respirator, these patients that are what we thought was the virus was causing pneumonia, no, these patients that are coming in and really suddenly becoming so sick, it's actually their own immune system that was causing the problem, not necessarily the virus. Now, don't get me wrong. This is a deadly virus, and just like an influenza virus, it can definitely cause pneumonia. It can definitely cause respiratory failure. If patients have emphysema or heart failure, it can definitely exacerbate those and lead, you know, to them to get into the ICU for those diseases as well. But this was doing something unique. This was doing something that I really hadn't seen much in my 20 years, where it was activating the immune system, and then now the immune system was causing all the destruction in the lungs, not just the virus itself. So in a way, this SARS-CoV-2 causes kind of two different clinical diseases. The first part of it is an infectious disease where the virus is a deadly virus and can seriously do some harm. But then the second, and I think this is probably the more important part, is it causes this activation of the immune system. And it doesn't cause it in all the patients, but it causes it in a subset of the patients that get hospitalized. And these are the patients that we found were coming into our ICU, the majority of the patients went in our ICU. And once I started noticing this, I started looking for markers. And these are many markers.
And how difficult is to find the markers, and can you be tested for that easily, or...
Yeah, these are not any unusual markers. Actually, a lot of the hospitals are checking the markers. But the problem is that there's about six or seven different markers. Some of the markers are important to rule out other disorders, like other infections or sepsis and those types of things. And then some of the markers are important to kind of let you know that this inflammatory issue is going on in these patients. So you have to look at every single patient individually. And you have to go through this kind of exhaustive checklist. One, make sure that there isn't any other problem. Two, then make sure that, you know, to check to see if they're having this inflammatory problem. And then if they are, then you have to kind of watch them very, very carefully. And
so if you're having the inflammatory problem, that's why I don't know if you're a believer in this or not, but why hydroxychloroquine might work with some patients and not with others?
Yeah, it's possible. I just think probably it wasn't a strong enough anti-inflammatory. It wasn't a strong enough immunosuppressant. Okay. And there's a lot of research. There's a lot of articles that came out and, you know, said that. And at this point, we're not really using azithromycin anymore, and the hydroxychloroquine. From system-wide has been kind of on an as-needed basis, an individual case that where you can discern whether the patient needs it or not. But the important thing was that, you know, when these patients had these inflammatory markers that were elevated, if you follow them very closely, You saw that, you know, a minority of them do have this problem where all of a sudden they rapidly, you know, get much worse. And they go from needing very little oxygen to needing to be intubated within a 6 to 12-hour process. And this was the exciting part where we can, before getting to that point, before needing to be on a respirator, we started treating them very aggressively with anti-inflammatory medication, with strong immunosuppressive medications, which is kind of counterintuitive. Right, you think that this patient is here, they have a virus, it's a deadly virus, it's killed, 200,000 people across the globe. But now, instead of treating the virus, you're actually giving medicine to suppress the patient's immune system, which is something that's really counterintuitive. But that was what worked for these patients. We were able to now, instead of putting those patients on a ventilator, we were able to give them the medicines, act fast and early, which is, I think, very, very, very important to detect it early and to treat it early. And then at that point, you know, we're able to prevent them from needing to go on a respirator. And that's what really has changed everything around for both of our hospitals over the past month.
So why do you think more people haven't discovered this protocol? Or are you getting calls from people, you know, from other doctors and hospitals?
I am getting calls from other doctors, and the calls I would say are kind of 50-50. There's a lot of doctors who unfortunately are looking for a quick fix, right? So what's the one test? What's the one medicine? And that's the one thing I can't stress any harder to you and your listeners is there isn't necessarily one test and there isn't any one particular treatment plan. Every patient has their own kind of individual disease. And we've had to treat every single patient, now probably going on 30 to 35 patients that we've treated actively with this, with a different regimen. Not everyone, you know, you can't treat everyone with the same treatments. There isn't a one-size-fits-all for this disease. You have to do your due diligence. You have to look at the patient in front of you and then, you know, come up with a treatment for the disease that patient is manifesting. You can't just go through the ICU and start handing out these medicines. If you give this medicine to someone who doesn't need it, you will surely kill them. So now you have to go through, you may have 10 patients in the ICU, and maybe three of them, maybe six of them have this, but the other three or four do not. So you can't just sit there and give this to everyone. You have to go through the process with each and every one of these patients and figure out what's going on with them, and then come up with the correct treatment for them.
One last question, doctor, and that is last weekend, two ER doctors from Bakersfield, they have seen more than 5,000 coronavirus tests. They held a press conference. The local media covered it, and they reported their findings and said the coronavirus is similar to the seasonal flu for the most part, and quarantine is not helping build a herd immunity. And they were confident that reopening was safe, but it was their personal opinion. This now has gone against what sounds spooky to me, the authoritative truth. Yesterday, the American College of Emergency Physicians and everybody else hammered them for this, for coming out and not walking in lockstep, and YouTube removed their video saying that it was not part of authoritative truth. Does that concern you at all that we are silencing people that might disagree but are not, you know, quacks?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you suppress someone's freedom of speech and their thought, you know, then I think that's dangerous. So I think, you know, especially from physicians who are on the front line, they need to be able to, you know, get out what they're thinking, what they're seeing. I think once you start suppressing that, it makes it very, very, very dangerous. The one other thing, Glenn, I wanted to kind of tell you, which is something that we've learned over the past week, is that so this virus not only causes the infectious disease, okay, which usually manifests in the first week, but the more important thing is it causes an autoimmune disease. Okay, now the cytokine storm is one part of it. But the autoimmune disease that it causes could be anything. So now you're reading about all these people who are getting blood clots, which are not responding to the common therapy, or people who have strokes, or people who have Guillain-Barré syndrome, which, you know, is a neuromuscular disorder, or people who develop myocarditis and cardiomyopathy and have sudden death. These are all an autoimmune disease that this virus triggers. Now, this isn't an unknown thing. We've known that viruses can, you know, trigger autoimmune diseases in the past. It's just that this virus does it at an extraordinary pace. It does it in a significant amount of the patients that we're seeing in our ICUs. And I think this is the part that I would like to get out, is that I don't think the doctors are recognizing that, you know, besides the virus causing damage, it's triggering an autoimmune disease, and it's the autoimmune process that's causing all the other parts. And it's important, Doctor, because – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Quickly finish. I'm sorry. We're just running out of time.
Of course. It's the autoimmune process that if we can detect early, okay, we're telling all these patients to stay home, stay home, stay home, and then by the time they're coming in, they're too sick. We're missing the part where we can pick up the autoimmune process. If we can detect it early, we can intervene early, we may be able to save a lot of these patients and maybe drastically change what we're doing in terms of, you know, having patients stay at home, having everyone be quarantined, and all those kind of things.
Great. Dr. Tom Yadigar, the ICU director, Providence Cedars-Sinai Tarzana Medical Center, thank you so much for speaking out, and thank you for sharing this information. And congratulations to all of the people that you work with on doing such an amazing job, not having any of the patients on a respirator, and so far you haven't lost a patient. Good job. Thank you so much. God bless. What I'm about to tell you is going to be banned, most likely on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and every place else, because it goes against the WHO. But 3 weeks ago, I called for a full audit of the WHO. At this point, you know about their assisted cover-up with the overlords of the Chinese Communist Party to try to hide the fact that China is directly responsible for the coronavirus pandemic. President Trump has rightly halted all U.S. funding to the WHO until we can find out what the heck is going on over there. Who's involved? How deep is this? I don't see the media asking any questions of any kind of substance. After Trump cut funding, the head of the WHO accused the president of politicizing the coronavirus. But the media, as usual, refuses to look into the political relationship between the head director, Tedros, of the WHO and the Chinese Communist Party. Now, let me give you a quick recap of what we were able to find just a few weeks ago. All of it I revealed on Blaze TV. If you're a subscriber, it can still be found on demand. It's really important. Tedros is the first WHO director to not have a medical degree. He's actually an Ethiopian politician. Now, I could be nice and start with he was the Ethiopian Minister of Health, but that's not where he was lately, and I'm going to get back to his posting as the Minister of Health here in a second. But his last job was with the Ethiopian government. He was their Minister of Foreign Affairs. He was basically their Mike Pompeo. He was also the chairperson of the Executive Council of the African Union. It is widely reported now that China has an intense connection with the past couple of decades with Africa, very specifically in Ethiopia, which has been dubbed China's dream in Africa. So exactly 1 year ago this month, Ethiopia hosted its second Belt and Road Summit. Now, Belt and Road is China's strategy to dominate all international trade. Apple and Samsung used to be the most popular phone companies in Ethiopia until China moved in. Now it's the Chinese phone maker Tecno. The Chinese presence in Ethiopia is staggering, and we went through it on Blaze TV. The Chinese construction companies are building structures all over the country. They fully funded a $47 million rail system and over 30,000 miles of roads. They proved 70% of the funds for another railroad that links Ethiopia to neighboring countries at a cost of $3.4 billion. The Chinese investment in Ethiopia is growing at a rate of 52% a year, still growing. That's a high price tag. How is Ethiopia ever going to pay that back? Well, the answer is they can't in cash. Since the year 2000, Ethiopia owes China over $12 billion. That's half of their entire external debt owed to the Chinese Communist Party. They have no way of ever repaying it, at least not with cash. No one in the media will ask these questions. And making even more ridiculous this whole situation is the fact that China has a track record for buying influence in international organizations within the UN. An official within the White House recently told Radio Free Asia that China's foreign investment in places like Ethiopia and Africa is part of a plan to, quote, reshape the international system to accommodate its political and economic interests. They go on. Quote, in service of this strategy, China has consistently sought to trade financial incentives for votes, offering bribes and canceling debt for countries that support them. Now, the Washington Post recently reported that China forgave Cameroon's debt just 1 month before they withdrew their country's candidate to head the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. China also threatened to cut off exports from multiple countries in South America if they didn't back their candidate to head the FAO. Guess who now sits at the head of that UN organization? Yes, the distinguished gentleman from China. So why is it suddenly out of bounds to notice the same mafia-style tactics from China directed at the WHO? In 2017, the WHO director shocked the world when he announced that he was naming President Mugabe of Zimbabwe a WHO goodwill ambassador. Mugabe, you know, as in the ruthless, human rights abusing, land grabbing, hyperinflation inducing dictator. Oh, and you can also tack Marxist, Leninist, and Maoist to that impressive resume. So why the heck did the WHO, more importantly, their director, think this was even a remotely good idea? Well, it all makes sense. If you see that China loved themselves some Mugabe, he was helping China move into Africa. They had strong ideological ties, Marx, Mao, Lenin, the current president, Xi Jinping, and Mugabe, all of them together. That's one heck of a party. The Washington Post reported that the WHO director's decision to honor Mugabe was speculated as, quote, a payoff to China, which worked tirelessly behind the scenes to help Tedros defeat the United Kingdom's candidate for the WHO job, David Nabarro. Tedros's victory was also a victory for Beijing, whose leader, Xi Jinping, has made public his goal of flexing China's muscle around the world. Really? This is the guy that everyone in the world, including our media, is claiming is acting in good faith when he covers up for China over the coronavirus. Not only did China have a deep ideological link with Mugabe in Zimbabwe, they also have a deep ideological link to the WHO director himself. Again, you won't get this information anywhere. What do I mean by that? Well, the government that he used to serve in Ethiopia are Marxist-Leninists. In fact, he wasn't just part of it. He's a member of and served both as health minister and foreign minister in the Ethiopian Tigray People's Liberation Front. Oh, I love them liberation fronts. It's a radical socialist movement that was so violent that they were officially designated a terror group. Some of their highlights include forced displacements and land seizures, torture, which include, and I'd like to quote here, prisoners were raped, tied to trees, held with animals, had water bottles hung from their genitals and their fingernails pulled out, and a slew of other human rights abuses. But that's what you get from Marxist revolutionaries. I know what you shouldn't expect. You shouldn't expect one of their members to become the director of the WHO. But what do you know? China saw a friend in both Tedros and his Marxist government buddies. They probably saw talent they could use when Tedros was allegedly caught covering up epidemics when he was the Minister of Health. I told you I would get back to that. Outbreaks of cholera were instead classified under him as, quote, acute watery diarrhea. despite the fact that outside experts tested stool samples and lo and behold, it was cholera, he said it wasn't. The Washington Post reported back in 2016 that certain European officials were lobbying hard to keep the words cholera and Ethiopia out of any conversation. Sure. Well, this kind of talent could be used by China. He appeared to have experience covering up epidemics. And he not only a member of cover-up, he also is a Marxist who is tied into a Marxist, a Leninist, terrorist political party. Wow. He was actually one of the 9 executive members of the Politburo, so he knows how China works. As Ethiopia's foreign minister, he helped China move into his country. In fact, let me quote a Facebook post from him. This is something that he posted in 2015. Under the Go Global program of JANA, we expect increased Chinese investment flow to Ethiopia. The 8 industrial parks identified throughout Ethiopia, some already under construction, will facilitate the migration of Chinese companies to Ethiopia. He even wrote an op-ed with his Chinese counterpart, one from 2014, entitled A Role Model for Bilateral Ties. This particular article was published in the Chinese Daily, a publication that is owned in its entirety by the Chinese Communist Party, more specifically the publicity department, otherwise known as the propaganda arm of the Communist Party. Now, all of this should be on the front page of every American and Western investigative news outlet in the world. The head of the WHO, who comes from a radical Marxist political party that was dubbed a terrorist organization, who covered up outbreaks when he was the minister of health in his own country, was helped into office by the Chinese government and has been caught doing favors for China. Now he's been caught repeating doing exactly the same thing with coronavirus. That's the story. The facts are clear. The WHO director is in with Communist China. We must stop listening to the WHO until they clean this mess up. Not a dime should go to them or, quite frankly, the UN until this is fixed. And then after that, we should still think about it. By the way, every word that I said is documented. Go ahead, throttle us, demonetize, remove this from Facebook, remove this from YouTube, throttle us, Google. You will only expose what you are really doing and who you are in bed with. So the chief product officer of YouTube, the platform that was created to let anyone with a camera in their home have a voice, the thing that really changed and transformed and empowered people for the first time. Well, they didn't mean to empower, people, just the right people. They now said that YouTubers who share their opinion on the news cannot provide context, and this is why they need to be suppressed and censored when it comes to newsworthy topics. Are you kidding me?
Mohan, who is much smarter than you are and can provide context for everything, made the comments during an interview with Protocol's editor-at-large David Pierce when he was asked whether health authorities changing their advice about the coronavirus, such as the way they change their recommendations around masks, is causing YouTube to maybe be slightly behind when it comes to moderating content. Well, Mohan said the changing guidance on masks reflects the actual underlying information that is changing in a fundamental way, really, really rapidly.
So he went on to say, as opposed to, somebody espousing their opinions about a mask, in their basement, this is coming from an authoritative channel,
a news source, a medical professional. And that's the case when we think there's going to be some context that's provided around the question of masks. Even if that guidance changes, it will be reflected in sort of how an authoritative voice or channel talks about it. Well, then explain why you took the two ER doctors off and banned them. Because they weren't authoritative, they're in the ER. They have treated 5,000 patients and administered 5,000 tests. Mo, have you done that? Has anyone in Google done that? Has anyone in CNN done that? No. You had to smear them. 5 million views, and they were finally taken down. Now Facebook is banning users for saying that they're proud to be English. Okay, well, normally I understand that. I mean, look at their teeth. They're proud to be English. It was on St. George's Day. That's the patron saint of England. That's St. George's Day. I don't know. It's like St. Patrick's Day for Ireland. And so people were proud to be English on St. George's Day. They'd be like, proud to be an American on July 4th. Oh, that's crazy. So they barred anyone who was proud to be English from posting, and anyone who shared the image of a St. George's cross with the white lion on a red field, a banner associated with Anglo-Saxons. There's the problem. They received messages informing them that they had been subject to various bans and suspensions because they had posted content which goes against our community standards on dangerous individuals and organizations. Oh, the Anglo-Saxons? What, St. George? Was he going to come charging you on his horse in his armor? What the hell is wrong with people? I am so sick. Trust people. That's the whole concept of America. Trust people. That's the whole concept of the internet. That's the whole concept of YouTube. Trust people. People will make interesting content. People will say interesting things. You may not like it. You may not agree with it. It may be wrong. But you're not a platform. You are now a propaganda arm for authoritative sources. So what are those authoritative sources that are not broadcasting from their basements? Of course, Chris Cuomo is an authoritative source at CNN. He can provide context from his basement for the last 3 months or 3 weeks. My gosh.
And Cuomo is particularly irritating because here's a guy who comes out and is preaching to everybody else how you have to follow the science. You have to be in touch with the science all the time. He did a big monologue about Trump's disinfectant press conference the other day.
Oh, shut up. Shut up. Who actually thinks that Donald Trump was encouraging people to inject Clorox or Pine Sol? And by the way, it was Pine Sol. It wasn't Clorox. So somebody didn't get the idea. They decided to riff on that. You know, I don't know, Clorox, that probably is bad, but Pine Sol smells like a tree, so it must be good.
It's from nature. Oh, it smells like trees. So just to give you a sense of what Cuomo's coverage is like, here is a clip from his show the other day.
Take two shots of Windex, swallow this light bulb, and call me in the morning. Come on, man.
From his basement.
Come on, man. So,
come on, man. I'm Joe Biden. Come on, man. I thought you liked me.
I know. It's just, he's so irritating. But again, just mocking Trump. And look, you know, you're not going to go to Donald Trump for health advice. He's the only person that goes to McDonald's more than me and you. Like, there's no one's going to Trump for health advice. However, if you had someone who was telling you that they should be the one to guide you for what you put in your body, that person should definitely be responsible for what they're saying about health.
Right, like an authoritative source, like somebody like Chris Cuomo, who's mocking the president on, you know, putting some Lysol into your body, which is completely not what he said, but
he's an authoritative source. So what is he recommending, Stu? What, you know, what kind of things makes him an authority?
Well, to understand that, you need to go to his wife and her magazine. It's called Purist Magazine. She runs this as her business. Ooh. And it's basically like
that.
Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, if you think Goop is too much for the peasants. Like, if you're you need it's an elitist version of Gwyneth Paltrow.
Right, so like the marble egg that you're supposed to insert inside of your vagina is like not marble, it's gold. Who would put marble in there?
Exactly.
It's got to be gold. Right, okay, I got it. Okay.
It's like, and also, if you think Goop has sold out to the medical establishment, you need to go to Purist Magazine right now. You're going to love it. So I'm going through this, and so she's writing on the blog all these things that she's doing, and some of this got some press. That she was advocating for people to take baths with bleach. Now, she's very clear. It's only a half a cup per 80 gallons, which is a big bathtub. The peasant bathtub is only, you know, the average bathtub, I think, is 30 gallons for what you actually use. But she wants 80 gallons of water and some of this. And she goes through all of these, like, home cures and, you know, natural type stuff. So I'm looking into this, and she starts talking about when she gets criticized, she mentions, well, this was all done at the direction of my doctor. And the doctor is Dr. Linda Lancaster. Now, okay, it's a doctor. Like, if a doctor is telling you to do something a little bit out there, okay. Well, she's a naturopathic doctor. And these doctors are recognized by almost half of the states in the United States as doctors. Not including New York, where she was getting the treatment. So she's not licensed there. But she, about half the states, this is recognized as a thing. Now, look, I don't, whatever. You could do whatever you want. If you want to try, baths, that's all. It's all on you. But you can't be the guy who is telling us we have to stay close to the science when this is your world. And it's not just his wife's magazine. It is legitimately the way he treated COVID-19. And they call it treatments throughout the blog. At times they say, well, there's no treatments. This is why I treated it this way. Here are the treatments. Things like, you know, cayenne pepper and ginger and olive leaf.
Oh, my gosh.
And all sorts of, you know, these sort of nice feel-good things. Now, Dr. Linda Lancaster, she, as you may know, Glenn, is the founder of the Light Harmonics Institute.
Oh, the Light Harmonics.
Yes.
I love that institute. That's my favorite. No, I'm thinking of the Light Harmonica Institute, which teaches you to play harmonicas with crystals and light refraction. But that's a different story.
And quietly. You play the harmonica lightly there. Here is Dr. Linda Lancaster describing how we recover from illness. I'm going to give you a hint. It's not medication.
The body has an innate ability to heal itself. We were born with this vital force that knows how to heal us. What interferes or what causes illness?
It's a good question. What causes illness? Now, you might say a virus.
That would be somebody with an opinion in the basement. That's not authoritative. We're going to get to her authoritative answer on what causes illness in just a second. Again, this is Chris Cuomo's doctor. And Chris Cuomo, of course, is an authoritative source. Us? No. Him? Yes.